Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. One of the legends of 20th century poetry wrote sparingly, but her work still resonates.
The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master.
That's the beginning of the poem One Art by Elizabeth Bishop. It's one of her best-known poems, published near the end of her life, and it was read there by actress Blythe Danner. It speaks of an art of losing, and Bishop had to practice that in her own life. Bishop, who grew up in Worcester, lost her father as a baby. Her mother was institutionalized through her childhood, and the rest of her life was marked by tumultuous love affairs, deaths of friends, and her battle with alcoholism. Joining me to talk about Elizabeth Bishop and her work is her new biographer and former student, Megan Marshall. Marshall's a professor at Emerson College, and her new book is Elizabeth Bishop, A Miracle for Breakfast. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me, Deborah.
So tell me about Elizabeth Bishop's contributions to poetry. What do you think made her one of the giants of 20th century verse?
Well, she came to the stage of poetry at a time where it was mostly male-dominated, but she managed to sneak in a kind of new poetry that was based in the old. She was attracted to verse forms. She wrote sestinas, villanelles, but she also incorporated a kind of modernism of everyday speech and of very acute observation. So she was writing in old forms, but she was writing new poetry.
And do you think that's why it still has such staying power?
Yes, I think so. You know, she said that to write poetry is thinking with one's feelings. I think that's a wonderful description of the kind of poetry that she wrote. Her contemporaries, Robert Lowell, Sylvia Plath, and Sexton, were writing very kind of nakedly revealing confessional poetry that was gripping at the time, but it loses a bit today when we're not any longer in the time in which they were writing and confessing. Her poems are personal, but they're also universal, just as the one that you read, One Art.
Right. So I'm wondering, you were a student.
Yes, I was.
Sorry. Yeah. So describe what happened there.
Yeah. Well, I was a dropout from Bennington College and hanging around in Harvard Square, and I began taking courses at Harvard just kind of as an independent person. I was lucky to get into a workshop class with Robert Lowell. And after those classes, I transferred to Harvard and continued to really to study poetry. That became my thing. I got into Elizabeth Bishop's class my senior year, and she was not the star that Robert Lowell was. It's hard to believe that now because her name has certainly ascended beyond his. And it was a curious class. We began day one. She said she appeared a kind of small, older woman looking kind of shy and nervous. And she began by saying, "I don't believe poetry can be taught." And what were we supposed to think about that? But I came to really respect that honesty. I mean, above all, this is what she was, honest in her poems. And if she wasn't outright open about her love life, her lesbianism, a word she would not have used because she was closeted, she was very honest in her opinions about what we might do as poets, what could be accomplished. And she had arrived at poetry almost as a life raft, I think, in a refuge and a place of expression through a very difficult life. I don't think that's part of what she felt couldn't be taught. And also, I think sometimes people who have a kind of innate talent for something aren't really the best teachers of it. But the message really was you had to, be rigorous on your own. You had to teach yourself. You had to write, inspire yourself, and live the life that was going to be the basis of poems.
Right. So she lost her father when she was a baby. Her mother was institutionalized. She was in a series of homes, sexually abused.
Yes, by an uncle.
By an uncle. She was a gay woman who was closeted and couldn't come out. I mean, there was a lot going on there. Is that picture what really interested you and made you want to write about
her?
Much
of what you've just summarized had not been known before. When I began to write this book, I was very aware that this experience as a student at Harvard with these eminent poets had kind of set me up for the life of a biographer. I was close to them, but maybe only as close as a biographer might ever come to a subject. I wanted to write about Bishop. I had thought I'd write a short book, kind of a personal appreciation. She published only 100 poems in her lifetime. But then when I began looking into it, I learned that her late life lover, Alice Methvessel, who was almost 30 years younger, had held on to some key correspondences, and they came to light after Alice's death in 2009. So the love affair between Alice and Elizabeth, nobody really knew what that consisted of until the letters between them surfaced. There were letters that Elizabeth had written in her late 30s when she was in psychoanalysis to her analyst, and that's how we know about the abuse from the uncle. This was something she'd never told anyone except very close friends. We also know about her early experiences of falling in love with girls and women. Previous biographers had sort of guessed, you know, they would say, well, she was working out her sexuality. We don't really know. But here, you know, we learned that she was reading Havelock Ellis when she was, a young teenager, learning about what then was called inversion, sexual inversion, love of the same sex. And luckily, Havelock Ellis was kind of, a liberal on this. She was not made to feel ashamed by what she was reading.
Hmm. And her struggle with alcoholism.
Yes. I mean, yeah, that too was becomes that, much more clear in these letters. No, that was known, but her feelings about it, she writes about it quite movingly in these letters to the analyst. One is that she began drinking, she dates it to her senior year in college as she was beginning to look out into a world where she really had no place to go, no home. She'd always had a girls. She went to a girls' boarding school, Walnut Hill School, and then the Vassar College. But this was also the year that her mother died. And even before her mother died, she had not seen her for 17 years while her mother was institutionalized. She was crying about her mother, she reveals in these letters, in the arms of her roommate, Margaret Miller, with whom she was in love but who didn't return that love. So she was drinking, and she says sometimes that was the only way that she could express herself. But she also clearly felt that sometimes she would experience visions and perceptions under the influence of alcohol, and that was sometimes helpful for her art. So you can see why it was very hard for her to give this up. She needed it to express things that she couldn't otherwise. Perhaps it opened up her up to a kind of imaginative vision that she used in her poetry. But she knew quite well it was costing her the love of people she cared about dearly.
You know, she wrote to her friend, the poet Robert Lowell, quote, "It is hell to realize that one has wasted half of one's talent through timidity."
Mm.
What does that mean? Was she really an insecure person?
Yes. Well, I don't know if insecure is the term. Socially insecure, we probably say now. She had a very strong belief in her talent, and I think that was one reason she was able to pilot her way through this very difficult life. She always was very true to this commitment to poetry. But shyness really plagued her from a very young age, perhaps because she was gay and had to hide that, perhaps because of the misery in her household. I mean, she made great friends at Walnut Hill School, but one of them dropped by this very humble house she was living in Revere, and she burst into tears to have this person unexpectedly drop by and meet the dreadful uncle and the rather embarrassing aunt with whom she was living.
So, and also, she never felt that her career was where she wanted it to be.
Well, in a way, it's sort of hard to see how that could be. She won the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, the National Book Critics Circle Award. But her great friend Robert Lowell was turning out, sometimes one sonnet a day, and here she was left with, the 100 poems. She had more still in her when she died at age 68. But I think it was more a question of output. But if you think about it, this is one thing that I tried to do with the book, to sort of situate the poems back in her life. And you see how the idea from the poem might begin, in 1947, a bus ride in Nova Scotia and Maine, a moose walks out on the road. This becomes a poem 20 years later that she reads at 5 Phi Beta Kappa ceremony at Harvard in 1972. Poems were with her all the time. And in a way, maybe it's not that her career wasn't where she was, but she was always had something to do that was unfinished. And I think, you know, we all know how that feels.
Right. Now, as we said, her mother was institutionalized, but she was also living at a time when other poets had issues with mental stability.
Yes.
So how was that for her? I mean, I see one quote here that's in your book. She says, "I am the one poet who's going to stay sane until the bitter end."
Yes.
So how did she navigate that world, and what do we know
about
her mental health?
Well, I think it was partly the other poets, but also that she did not want to lose a grip in the way that her mother had, and it was very important to her. It's been said that when she died of a cerebral aneurysm, she probably would have been happy to know that that was how she ended her life, not as a suicide. So many of the poets of her generation did, one way or another. So the alcoholism was not quite manageable, but it was not insanity. She needed to hang on to the very acute vision that she had, and you see it in her poetry. Very striking descriptions of animals, of nature, the beaches, the way the sun shines, all these things. It was a clarity of vision that she strove for, and maybe you're right. You can see it as part of this incessant need to have a sane view of the world and to think with one's feelings.
What do you want people to understand about Elizabeth Bishop, both as a poet and as a person?
Well, you know, I've written three biographies now, and I've come to think that there are some very distinctive brands of heroism. Some are very public, but some, like Elizabeth Bishop's, are more private. She did have a public persona in her poetry, but she, despite all that she fought against, the alcoholism, the shyness, she persevered. She made something beautiful, and she staked her life on that. And I think that's an example we can all take to heart now.
Where do you think she got, now that you've gone through all of these things that weren't known before, where did she get the guts to do that, I guess? And what was it?
Well, she had a love of language from the very beginning. You hear her talking about, in retrospect, the hymns that were sung in the Baptist church that she went to, the rhymes that stuck with her, the unusual lines. These were a way of getting through a very difficult life, hanging on to language. And this is something I can identify with. In a way, that's a bit of why my story is in the book as well, in these brief memoir sections. This is a woman who held on to language as a way of staying part of the human community that otherwise was turning its back on her.
And in the last minute here, the exact title of the book is Elizabeth Bishop, A Miracle for Breakfast. What does that mean for folks who don't
know? Yeah, this is the name of a sestina that she wrote, a very complicated verse form that had not been popular when she tried it in the 1930s, but became popular as this poem circulated out into the world. I like the title because it grabbed this kind of cheerfulness, this effort to rise above that was so much true of Elizabeth Bishop.
All right. Megan Marshall, author of Elizabeth Bishop, A Miracle for Breakfast. She'll be reading from the book at the Brookline Booksmith this Wednesday and Harvard's Houghton Library next Monday. You can find more details at our website, radioboston.org. Megan Marshall is also the winner of the 2014 Pulitzer Prize in Biography for her book on Margaret Fuller. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Deborah.
Stay with us. Coming up, the surprising life story of Julia Ward Howe, who wrote the lyrics to the Battle Hymn of the Republic. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.